It's crazy to know that so many people have been diagnosed and don't have any way of supporting that diagnosis.
That really isn't surprising to me.
I need support with my ADHD because this isn't helping me.
Or at least it's not helping me enough.
It's a large number of people with ADHD. I mean, if you ever wondered if you're alone, the answer is not really. Not according to this. Hi, and welcome to this week's ADHD Research Recap. Today, we're going to be talking about more of a generalized sample. Basically, a lot of the papers that we've been talking about in the past, we've sort of said, hey, this is just one paper, and this is just one group of people. And today, we're going to be talking about two papers that have populations in the millions, the hundreds of thousands. So we're going to sort of go in the opposite extreme, and we're going to focus on something that's more generalizable to the whole population, particularly if you live in the US. But as I live in New Zealand and Sarah lives in the US, we're going to be able to provide that kind of international US combination perspective, which is real cool. So I'm looking forward to it. So the first thing we're going to talk about today is a paper that looks at risk factors associated with newly diagnosed ADHD in adults. And this is a retrospective case study. So it's looking at the past. And yeah, basically what they wanted to know is, what does the US health data tell us about people who've just been diagnosed with ADHD, which I know for a lot of you guys is probably something that has happened to you. A lot of people, a lot of adults now are quite late diagnosed. So tell us a little bit about how they did this, Sarah.
So this was really interesting because I have never heard of the databases that they were pulling this data from. So they called it an archival study, and they were using a Pharmetrics database, which is basically just integrated medical claims information. So if you've ever been to the doctor's office, they're going to give you sort of either a diagnosis, some kind of treatment. They might have to put in some kind of other code, maybe for a wellness visit or something like that. Or if you've ever gone to the pharmacy to pick up a medication, that's also going to be on your sort of medical claims information. Yeah, crazy. It's like your permanent record.
Yeah. Who knew that? I mean, I knew they had this data, but I didn't know that they were using it for research. It makes sense. It's a little bit creepy.
A little bit. Yeah. I mean, it's not that much different from the Sweden study databases, but the potential sample size for this is over 190 million people use or have information on this specific database, which is a lot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 100%. And this is a US database, for those of you who are interested. So it's quite interesting. We talked about this. They looked at whether you had two or more ADHD diagnoses submitted on medical claims. So Sarah, can you run us through kind of what that would look like? Examples of where you might get an ADHD diagnosis submitted on a medical claim.
Sure. So this is basically just talking about their different cohorts of the sample. So the ADHD cohort, you know, you had to have two or more ADHD diagnoses submitted on your medical claims, which means that if you've ever had an assessment for ADHD and were diagnosed, that provider would have had to submit your ADHD diagnosis to your insurance. If you've ever received psychotherapy or had a psychiatric medication, all of those types of things would go into this medical claim system process through insurance.
Yeah, no, definitely. And in the end, they went with 337,000 ADHD people. And how many non-ADHD people? Is that the number that
I'm looking at? Just over a million. They wanted to have like a 3-to-1 ratio with a larger control group. So that was really cool. So yeah, they basically just kept pulling people until they got their required ratio.
Yeah.
But honestly, I thought the way that they defined being in the ADHD cohort was really strange. There are lots of people who go seeking diagnosis and then are brushed off. And so those are missed cases. There are people who sort of are diagnosed, but then never receive treatment, which we'll talk about in the next paper. And those people would be completely missed by the study as well. So
yeah.
I don't know. I like scoured this paper looking for their justification of that, and I did not find one.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think It's also about like the purpose of the paper. And it looks like from what we're seeing, the purpose of this paper would be to probably, I mean, if I think about where this paper is from, it's from the Medical Journal of Psychiatry. So it would be sort of gathering more data for the purposes of psychiatry rather than for understanding ADHD for ADHD people specifically.
Yeah, I mean, one of their sort of quotes that they say later in the paper is that, you know, they hope that this information that they come away with, it can help clinicians identify people with ADHD sooner and minimize those missed opportunities.
So, yeah, no, that's
good. Yeah, you know.
That's a good point. I mean, I'm happy with that.
The other information that they were looking at was sort of demographics and then physical and psychological diagnoses and treatments. So basically comorbidities.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And so what did they find when they looked at these demographics?
Well, the sort of first and isolated finding was that both cohorts were slightly majority female. So both were slightly over 50% female. So I don't know if that has any bearing on the rest of it.
Probably just a bearing on who tends to be on in any doctor's office for anything at all. I think we know that that is a majority female population.
Very true. And then, I mean, I guess when we look at the comorbidities that were the most common, it also makes sense that the sample was primarily female because the most prevalent mental health comorbidity was anxiety disorders. So almost 35% of their sample was also diagnosed with an anxiety disorder. Depression was sort of 28%. And then sleeping disorders, trauma, and substance abuse also made the list.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that sleeping disorders made the list because we have talked about it before, but I think often when we're having this conversation, you can kind of see it in these stats. We're often talking about anxiety and depression, which makes sense because it does make 34% and 27% of the sample. But the great thing about having such a big sample is that we can see, okay, sleeping disorders is a significant number of the ADHD population, at least in this study, which I think is interesting considering how many people I know are listening who are like, yeah, I would probably class myself as having a sleeping disorder.
I should also mention that 58% of the ADHD sample had at least one other diagnosis on record. Whereas only 30% of the non-ADHD group even had a co-occurrence.
Yeah, yeah. It's a fun cluster.
I should say a single occurrence.
Yeah, it's a real cluster of things that we can have with ADHD. It's described as a variety of things. It's also interesting when we look at the pharmacological treatment. 40% of patients in the ADHD cohort received antidepressants. That's a very high number.
That really isn't surprising to me. They always try to say that your executive functioning challenges are as a result of your depression. So you have to treat that first, obviously. And that's going to solve all my problems.
Somebody is salty about this. but yeah, no, it is interesting. For a number of people, this has been a particularly helpful thing, but you are right that there are a number of people we've spoken to, at least anecdotally, and been, you know, as well, who have to go through the antidepressant space and sort of titrate that in order to understand that actually I need support with my ADHD because this isn't helping me.
Or at least it's not helping me enough, right? Like plenty of people take an antidepressant in combination with an ADHD medication, and that can be a winning combination for some people. But for an ADHD person to only be treating their depression can possibly feel like having two broken legs and one crutch.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. Hopefully it's less common now because we've got all the studies that say, hey, you should probably check this person for ADHD. You would be surprised. But, you know, there is a thing in the past where there would be the feeling of, you know, okay, I feel like I'm like 70% good, 60% good, but there's still that other 30 to 40% and people kind of going like, no, there's not. No, there's not. This is it. This is just you. And that can be really, really disheartening.
It's where a lot of our internalized shame comes from, you know, because we do. We grow to accept that these things are just character flaws. instead of sort of just needing support.
Yeah. No, 100%. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
And talking about needing more support, probably their most important finding here is what they were conceptualizing: healthcare resource utilization. So that means how often do you utilize healthcare as a resource? You know, do you go to a therapist? Do you go to the emergency room often, clinics, your primary care? And they found that actually the ADHD cohort had way more interventions, sort of like, hey, I have all these symptoms, please help me. Hey, let's treat this. Oh no, this didn't help me.
That's so interesting. That's really, so we were just more around, you know, in terms of the document, you just found us on the document a bit more often.
I suppose that's a good way of looking at it.
Yeah. They were like, oh, you again, rather than like, oh, this is the one time this person turned up.
Oh, the reason why I didn't include the numbers on this is because they're in like ranges of numbers of appointments. And so it's things like 0.6 to 1.7. And so it just doesn't make any sense. But
but yeah, essentially with ADHD, they're finding more emergency room visits, more specialist visits, more psychotherapy visits, all of those kinds of things.
Yeah, their ultimate point was that looking at these specific comorbidities, you know, depression, anxiety, sleep disorder, trauma, in combination with how often this person accesses medical resources, and that would be a super big red flag that this person should be assessed for ADHD.
Yeah.
They did a little bit of like fictitious patient modeling where they like combined all of specific variables into different permutations. And they found that if you receive treatment for anxiety and depression, this fake patient was 81% more likely to receive an ADHD diagnosis within the coming year.
Wow. Wow. That is huge.
Whereas the low risk patient that they created only received a 1.5% chance of receiving a diagnosis.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, so definitely one of the benefits, I guess, of this paper is that they are building a profile, which, yeah, building profiles have their pros and cons, but they're building a profile of somebody who is likely to have ADHD, essentially.
It's sort of like troubleshooting the diagnosis problem. Like, you know how when you're having technology problems and the computer wants to run you through troubleshooting steps and then it's like, try this and see if it helps. This is sort of just like, hey, if you have depression and anxiety, maybe take this detour and see where it goes.
Yeah. See where you're at. See if this is it. Yeah. And hopefully, it would be nice, I think, for a lot of people to get to a place. This is an ideal, but it would be wonderful to get to a place where they were able to do enough of this kind of troubleshooting, which didn't involve you taking multiple different kinds of medications to figure it out. Like at the moment, a lot of that troubleshooting is try this med, tell me how you feel. And if it doesn't work for you, then we'll keep trying different things until maybe we figure out you actually need ADHD support. And that can be an incredibly long, incredibly disheartening, incredibly confusing process for a lot of people.
That is so true. Yeah, I look forward to those days.
Yep. Come on, guys. We're rooting for you.
I'm going to sort of briefly touch on the limitations of this study because we're going to actually talk about them again with the next study.
Yeah.
But essentially, the biggest one is that, you know, all of their analysis relies solely on the available medical data. And so we know that underdiagnosed or misdiagnosed people could have been left out. Likewise, if you paid cash for your stuff and didn't run it through insurance or don't have insurance, this study wasn't going to pick you up either.
Yeah. No, and I think that's really, really important to note because that's going to be a significant minority of people, essentially, who will be in that position.
We know that ADHD can feel overwhelming and frustrating, and that's on a good day. And we don't want anyone to have to navigate that alone.
That's why we created the ADHD Academy, where adults with ADHD can meet, join, share stories, and support each other in a judgment-free way. If you want to connect with others who truly understand you and learn research-based strategies to help you feel more in control and build momentum in your life and work, you found the right place.
Together, let's transform your ADHD challenges into strengths. If you'd like to know more, you can click the link below to join us in the ADHD Academy.
Hope to see you there.
So let's jump into the next paper, and then we can sort of talk about the practical implications and the some more of the limitations as a group, because they're sort of similar, both of them. So the second paper looked at the predictors and prevalence of multimodal treatment among U.S. adults with ADHD. This was from the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, which we haven't really talked about a lot. But what they basically wanted to do was they wanted to examine the trends of receiving multiple or multimodal treatment for ADHD over the course of 5 years between 2017 and 2021, which ironically is actually the same time period as the study we just talked about. And they wanted to get a sense of, actually, Sarah, what did they want to get a sense of specifically?
Yeah, so they pretty much came in their introduction and were like, okay, so we know from the research that multimodal treatment is the most effective for ADHD and has significant and lifelong improvements. Mm-hmm. So let's see if people are actually getting that. And they looked at it for 5 years.
Which is a lot. Do you want to define what multimodal means for those of us who are just a bit confused?
So multimodal treatment just means that you're receiving more than one type of treatment for your condition. Mm-hmm. So treatment options for ADHD might be psychotherapy. They might be medicine. They might be coaching. They might be a mindfulness practice or yoga or some other type of wellness practice. It can be any combination of things, but the point is that it is a combination of things.
Yes, which is really important. And I think it's really nice to see the concept of ADHD support being multimodal coming into it. Because if you have ADHD, and as we've seen in the last paper, it also means you're likely to have anxiety or depression or a sleep disorder. You can see it's going to be hard to find one person or one system of treatment that's going to support all of those different areas.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, human beings are so complex. Lots of different systems running, all need different types of support.
Exactly. We need a team, or, you know, Whitney mentioned a couple of sessions ago, we need a village. Okay. So what was the methodology? Again, this is another big nationally representative US database.
Yeah. So basically the exact same thing as the last study, except it was a different system. So it was just a different group of people. The names mean nothing to me because they are not sort of correlated directly with any type of insurance. So yeah, it's not important. But sort of this was another gigantic sample. They were only sort of looking at the people with ADHD. So that was just under 500,000 US adults.
Yeah. And those were the ones who registered for clinical treatment between 2017 and 2021, which is actually interesting because, I mean, that right there is an interesting number. Just over 500,000 people registered for clinical treatment. If we take that and then we think about the number of people who would have liked to register for clinical treatment, who wanted to, who don't have insurance, it's a large number of people with ADHD.
That is a gigantic number, even over 5 years.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you ever wondered if you're alone, the answer is not really. Not according to this. So take me through a little bit more about the methodology, what they were looking for specifically.
Yeah, so this one was looking at some of the same types of measures, gender, regional location, income levels, but they were mostly looking for what type of treatment you received. So there were four different groups: no treatment, prescription only, therapy only, or both. And then they were also looking at what type of insurance you had at the time of diagnosis. What type of provider did you see that gave you your diagnosis? You know, was it a physician or was it a nurse practitioner? They were looking at co-occurring anxiety and depression. And basically, they were just sort of looking at all of those things together over the time span. What did the numbers say in 2017 compared to 2021?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's really interesting. They sorted people into three treatment types. So there was no treatment, prescription only, therapy only, or both. And they also did have those different sections, like you said, the health insurance, the provider, et cetera. But what did they specifically find? Because this is a very interesting finding.
A lot of the characteristics that they looked at were stable. Both time periods had largely female sample. The sample was mostly sort of in the 18 to 34 age bracket, almost 62%. Type of insurance also remained consistent. Mm-hmm. But some things changed. So in 2017, 52% of the population was female. Mm-hmm. Whereas in 2021, 62.5% of the population presenting for diagnosis mm-hmm. was female.
It's almost like we all found out about ADHD over COVID.
Oh, that's crazy.
I was actually diagnosed around that time. That's so strange.
Yeah. Same, actually. I wonder mm-hmm. if I'm in this database.
Yeah, probably.
The provider type changed. So mm-hmm. sort of the percentage of people that were diagnosed by physicians dropped from 52 to 40%.
Oh, interesting.
While obviously those non-physician providers, you know, the APRNs increased from 26 to 32%.
Can you explain what a non-physician provider would look like in this context in the US?
Yeah. So we're looking at like a medical doctor, an MD versus mm-hmm. a nurse or a mental health counselor or something like that. Someone who's not a medical doctor.
Wait, so can you get diagnosed by a nurse in the US? Because in New Zealand, you have to be diagnosed by a clinical psychologist or by a psychiatrist. And I'm probably missing a few people mm-hmm. as well.
I'm not exactly sure, but I know that primary care physicians can mm-hmm. diagnose you. Mm-hmm. Obviously, psychologists and psychiatrists can mm-hmm. diagnose you. But then in the United States, there's also what we call an APRN, which is an mm-hmm. advanced nurse practitioner, and they can diagnose and prescribe medication to you.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I'm not totally sure if that's the case where I am or outside of the US. I'd be interested to know if anyone has any information to definitely share it with us. We can kind of add it to our database. But yeah, that is interesting that increased by, you know, the funny thing is it increased by almost as much, not quite, but almost as much as the amount of women who were suddenly being diagnosed. Oh.
All the doctors quit after COVID.
Yeah. And all the nurse practitioners were like, maybe these women should be diagnosed with ADHD as well.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah. I mean, obviously, we are seeing sort of doctor shortages, you know, particularly in the United States. There are areas that we call like resource deserts. So like there's no doctor within hours of you, of where you mm-hmm. live.
Man, that's rough.
You know, sort of the more isolated you are, the worse off that is. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot to be said for just the resources available to the people.
Definitely, definitely. Okay. And in terms of kind of, you know, one of the interesting things that they found was that 25% of patients received no treatment for ADHD. So do you want to take us through what that means?
Yeah, so obviously they were looking at the different types of treatment that people were receiving. And the best numbers, the most recent numbers, suggest that a quarter of people who are diagnosed with ADHD do not receive any treatment for that ADHD.
Mm-hmm. Which is a lot.
That's a lot. Mm-hmm. Almost 54% received one type of treatment. So maybe they mm-hmm. were going to see a therapist or maybe they were just taking meds. So that's the bulk of the sample was receiving mm-hmm. one type of treatment. But mm-hmm. the gold standard that they were looking for, that multimodal approach, only 21.5% were receiving that kind of care.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Although you did note that that went up from 12% at the beginning of the study to 21% at the end of the study. So
that's
it's
true.
It's been a big jump, but it's definitely a very small minority of the number of people who've been diagnosed.
Yeah, it's still sort of inefficient, ineffective. Mm-hmm. Just knowing that you have ADHD doesn't necessarily give you like the answer to the problem.
Yeah, I will say, though, you know, obviously, if we're thinking about how this is recorded, they're only identifying things that would show up in your insurance claim. So if you were getting independent support, so for example, our academy, that wouldn't show up because it wouldn't be on an insurance claim at this point.
That's true. But also, you can think about the people in the United States who are living without any insurance, which would significantly limit their ability to access any type of treatment, possibly even diagnosis.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
And so that 21% might actually be an overestimate.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, that's so crazy. It's crazy to know that so many people have been diagnosed and don't have any way of supporting that diagnosis. It's like knowing that something is wrong, but not actually having the resources to fix that problem. And I think a lot of people are in that position right now. A lot of times when we talk to people, as we always do, sort of coming through the academy, it's like, I know that I have this, but I didn't know anything about how to resolve it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's really on the diagnosing provider, at the very least, to provide that person some kind of next steps. Because if it's anything we're not good at as ADHD people, it's like knowing what the next step is inherently. So, you know, that's really kind of an area that we could provide some better support for sure.
That is true. That is like, yeah, if you're diagnosed with executive functioning difficulties, which is, you know, ADHD, you might want to include a little bit of an infographic, a flow chart.
I'm going to do this again. It's like going to the doctor and being like, I'm really tired. And they're like, yeah, well, you have anemia.
Yeah.
Bye. And that's it. And they don't tell you how to fix it.
And you don't know how to fix it because
they don't do
you're
that.
Not a doctor. Yeah. Yeah.
But why do they do it with mental health?
Yeah. Well, I think part of it is as well, like they very, until very recently, were like, we're not sure. Go see a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm. Also like, yeah, I don't want to be held liable for any of this.
Yeah. And also like, ADHD supports are so new. Like the idea of anything besides you should get a planner being a support is so new.
Yeah. I mean, to give the benefit of the doubt, like it does take some very specialized knowledge to learn how to support people with ADHD. And most providers just don't have that.
Yeah. I mean, we've taken a long time. Like we've been developing strategies and learning them and testing them. And we have ADHD. So we know what to look for. We know if it's not
bit
working.
Of an advantage.
Yeah, really. We're like testing our own treatments.
I am a case study.
Just constantly case studying your own life, basically.
My whole family.
It's so true. Okay, so what are some of the limitations? Let's talk about that.
I mean, it's pretty much the exact same ones as the previous study. You know, they took this information from health insurance databases. So they even said straight in the article that if you didn't have insurance, you weren't going to be included in this study. And arguably, the uninsured population are the most vulnerable and the most lacking supports. So yeah, while this is like widely generalizable, perhaps not for like low-income individuals or people who live in isolated communities.
Yeah, and I think that's really important to recognize, especially, I mean, we always want to recognize the limitations of our studies. What about the practical implications? If 25% of the people that they found receiving no treatment for ADHD, that's some practical implications right there.
If you are listening and you're one of those 25%, I'm going to just encourage you to find some kind of support. Whether right now that's just social support, you know, community support that you can lean on. Perhaps you find some kind of support group if that's applicable to you. If you have the resources, exploring meds or therapy could be appropriate. It's important to acknowledge the logistical avoidance of finding treatments. Oftentimes, the onus is on us to like decide what it's going to be and how to access it. And that's okay. People will stay with bad providers that they just don't vibe with because they don't want to go through the admin.
That's so true. Yeah.
So acknowledge that. it's okay. Reach out. People want to support you.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you want to hear from you.
Yeah. I was going to say, you know, I got an email from somebody the other day, one of our listeners, which was lovely and amazing. So if you want to, you can always reach out to admin at unconventional organization and just send us an email and we will try and help you as much as we can. We've got a wonderful ADHD friendly admin team. So if you are one of those 25% and you want some starting point, we can see what we can do to help you with that because it is tough and you do want to just be like, I don't know. Like a lot of the people who come through our consults, I've sort of stopped saying like, what specific support do you want? Because if they haven't told you already, the answer is, I don't know. I just know I have ADHD and it might be affecting my life. And it probably is in many ways that I don't even know yet.
Yeah. And you know, that's sort of the quarter of people that don't have any support. But let's talk to the majority of people who are sitting mm-hmm. here listening and have like a type of support. First of all, I am so proud of you for getting that support and for sticking to it. And I'm so happy for you that it's working. Mm-hmm. However, there are lots of wonderful additional things that we could do mm-hmm. that will support you in a much more robust way. Paying attention to some type of wellness practice, you know, mm-hmm. maybe exercise isn't your thing. Maybe yoga isn't your thing. Maybe like mindfulness in the shower can be your thing, or mindfulness yeah. while washing dishes can be your thing. Mm-hmm. Really just giving yourself permission to like notice the thoughts as they're whizzing around in your head. Yeah, really just embrace that part of yourself mm-hmm. and that mm-hmm. sort of acceptance, that sort of self-acceptance and self-awareness mm-hmm. will serve you elsewhere.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And, you know, knowing that from this, at least the perspective of the people who wrote this paper, having multiple methods of support is the gold standard. So don't yes. feel like, oh, well, I already have meds, so I can't possibly also want therapy. Or I already have therapy, I can't possibly also want meds. Or I can't possibly also want coaching and therapy. Or whatever mm-hmm. combination works for you. Like the combined support is the helpful gold standard support. So it's okay to ask for more than one. Yeah. Sarah's nodding at me.
Maybe listening to a podcast talking yeah. about a topic of your interest can be considered mm-hmm. sort of a self-care practice. Also, one of the things that was suggested to me when I went through a period of uninsuredness, carve out the time that you would devote to the therapy session and do something like journaling or something that grounds you or relaxes you or cares mm-hmm. for you. Mm-hmm. So that could be an alternative if you're sort of lacking in resources or time or whatever.
Yeah, there's lots of different ways. There's lots of different ways. The key is to reach out and try and get started. A lot of times with ADHD, that accountability is such a big part of it. You need somebody to help you press that start button on what you're trying mm-hmm. to do. Often it's about just reaching out and saying, hey, this is me pressing the start button. You have to take it from here. And if you reach out to us, we will do that because we understand. We have the whole flow chart for that reason because, yeah, it is hard to press that button. Okay. Well, really interesting papers. Sort of very different from what we were usually talking about, but I think very interesting to be able to look at a more generalized population sample and get some information from that. And shout out to Sarah. For those of you who don't know, Sarah organizes these papers. She puts them into a document. She reviews them. She finds all the extra things. So yeah, very much a big labor of love on her side before we even get to talking to you guys.
Thank you. Thank you.
Awesome.
You should see me while I'm going through it too, because I'll like read a sentence and be like, what? That's ridiculous. And then I have to go like look at it, or I'm like looking up words. Yeah, my personality really comes out to play in all of this. So I think that's why I really love it.
Yeah. And we're so lucky that you do, because it's so nice when Yay! We get to talk to it. Awesome. Well, great to see you all, guys. And we'll see you in 2 more weeks for another research recap. Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to reach out or connect with us, you can leave us a message at admin@unconventionalorganization.com.
You can also find out more about our ADHD coaching organization, read our free articles, or sign up to our online courses at unconventionalorganization.com. That's organization with a Z or an S. They both will get you there.
If you'd like to learn more about what we discussed here today, or you want to read the transcript, you can find that at our show notes page at unconventionalorganization.com.
If you've enjoyed this podcast and think someone else might find the strategies and stories helpful, the best thing you can do is share episodes using the share button in the podcast player, or leave a 5-star review on Apple or Spotify or your podcast player of choice, letting them know why you've benefited from this podcast.
Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you back in the ADHD lab next week.